CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca. And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day.
You can paint a picture which puts people in despair, or you can, without inventing anything, you can find those episodes and then those moments in history which suggest to you that something else is possible, even if that something else has not yet taken place on a big enough scale. You know, I think of Albany, Georgia. When I think of Albany, Georgia, I think of these hundreds and hundreds of black people lined up in front of the desk of the chief of police of Albany, Georgia, to be booked, you know, their names, addresses, and at one point the chief looks over the top of his desk and there's somebody there and he can just barely see the top of his head, and it was a 9-year-old kid being arrested, and the chief said, "Boy, what's your name?" And the little boy replied, "Freedom, freedom." Those are the kinds of things that happen 1,000 times in different ways in every social movement in this country, that the spirit that people have and which, no matter what they do, cannot really be extinguished.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn in the first of a 2-part program entitled A People's History of the United States. You want to read a real history book? Matt Damon asks Robin Williams in the movie Good Will Hunting. Read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. That book will knock you on your ass. It'll do that and more. Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States has sold more than 2 million copies, and it keeps on selling. Zinn's close friend Noam Chomsky said the book changed the consciousness of a generation. Zinn's history from below approach was to foreground, as he said, the countless small actions of unknown people. It was a sharp departure from the standard big man theory of history, General so-and-so, President so-and-so, etc. Always ready to lend a hand, Howard Zinn believed in and practiced solidarity. Witty, erudite, generous, and loved by many, Howard Zinn, friend and teacher, passed away in 2010. His words continue to inspire many the world over. "We don't have to wait," he said, "for some grand utopian future. To live now, as human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory." This classic from the AR archive was recorded at Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 1995. And now, Howard Zinn.
I came across a book recently called The Art and Politics of College Teaching. Any of you ever hear of it? No. Well, I'm not surprised. But it's a kind of Machiavellian guide to people who want to teach in college. It has sort of organized in the form of concerns. And concern number 9, I skipped the first 8 for your benefit. Can I involve myself in causes, crusades, and political activism as a professor? Answer: The institution of higher education may not look kindly upon such activities. Be wary of introducing your political conclusions or social thought into classroom situations. Be on guard not to take sides, if it is possible to avoid it at all. Play dumb. That's interesting. Until you get your PhD, the advice is play smart. And then after you get your PhD, play dumb. Be somewhat submissive to the senior faculty. The only thing about that I didn't understand was the word somewhat. I thought that took courage. Yeah. If I'd had that book available to me when I started my teaching career, I mean, who knows what I might have become? A dean, maybe. Anyway, I've always been interested in teaching as a profession, and the whole idea of professionalism, which ties in with Machiavelli, that is the idea of just doing well whatever it is somebody tells you to do, without asking why or what. And I have something here that was written by Leslie Gelb, a writer for the New York Times during the Gulf War, who at the end of the Gulf War was just ecstatic over the professionalism of the American Army in the Gulf War. And he had worked for the Rand Corporation and for the United States government, and he was in the habit of not asking questions other than professional questions, and so it was only fitting now that he should work for the New York Times. And I remember that I saw a review not long ago of the autobiography of Leni Riefenstahl. You know, I started to call her the Nazi filmmaker, but then I realized she wouldn't like it. And, so let's put it this way. She was a filmmaker who worked for the Nazis. And in this review, the reviewer in the New York Times talked about her involvement with Hitler. When I say involvement with Hitler, I don't mean it in the sense of, you know, People magazine or met Hitler a few times, had lunch with Goebbels. If you can imagine having lunch with Goebbels. she is in the world of film. Her technique is admired enormously, and the reviewer ends up this review of her book by saying something like, "She may have compromised her morality, but her artistic integrity never." And then I remember when the Mumia Abu-Jamal was facing execution last August, and I don't know how many of you have heard of the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, but when the campaign was on for Mumia Abu-Jamal, I remember at the very time, just before his scheduled date of execution, and when there's a campaign going on around the country, indeed around the world, to stop his execution, there was a meeting, it so happened, at that very time, in Philadelphia, which is the site of all of that, of Jamal and MOVE and the Pennsylvania governor coming into office promising to carry through all of the executions that were planned in the state of Pennsylvania. And just at that time, the Association of Black Journalists met in Philadelphia and debated the question of whether they should call for a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal, which is what the campaign was for. E.L. Doctorow, the novelist, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying, as many people did, we don't really know the facts of this case. It's hard to know. We have conflicting evidence. Who can say for sure whether Mumia Abu-Jamal killed this policeman or not? But judging from the way the trial was conducted, from the way the witnesses were brought forth, from the prejudice of the judge, who was proud of having sentenced more people to death than any other judge, he deserves a new trial. And this is what people were asking for, and this is what the Association of Black Journalists was debating, and they finally decided not to call for a new trial, but to make some statement short of that. And one of the grounds for not declaring themselves boldly in favor of a new trial was that they felt it was not their job as journalists to do that. Our job, as one of them put it, our job is to advance ourselves professionally and to do everything we can do to advance the profession, and somehow this doesn't fit in. Come to think of it, I just thought of another example, and which, in my own profession, sometimes I consider myself a member of the historical profession, just for speech purposes, during the Vietnam War, there was a business meeting of the American Historical Association. Oh, thanks. Well, thank you. Now I'll have to read what they really said. But at this meeting of the American Historical Association, you know these annual scholarly meetings. Some of you may be really lucky and get to go to some of them. And we're right in the midst of the Vietnam War, and there was at all of these scholarly meetings, all these papers are presented, but there's always a business meeting which is attended. The whole thing is attended by thousands of people who come from all over the country for that one annual meeting. And then there's a business meeting, which is usually attended by 32 people. Because can you imagine how exciting would be the business of the American Historical Association? But this time, at this meeting, the place was jammed because everybody had heard that there was going to be a resolution introduced at the business meeting calling for the American Historical Association to denounce American policy in Vietnam and to call for the withdrawal of American forces from Vietnam. And so everybody came. And we introduced the resolution. In fact, I confess that I introduced the resolution. wearing dark glasses. We had a lively debate on it, as lively a debate as you can have at the American Historical Association. And the resolution was defeated. And the main ground for its defeat was that it really wasn't relevant to the work of historians. Immediately after my resolution, or our resolution, the resolution of what was called the Radical History Caucus. I don't know why I've always been somehow part of something called the Radical History Caucus. So But after that was defeated, somebody else got up and proposed another resolution, which said exactly what my resolution had said, except that it added the words, because the money that's going for the war could otherwise be used to advance the profession of history. That resolution passed overwhelmingly. So I'm glad you're all going to be professionals. And the problem is how to work in a field without becoming a professional in that sense of the term, in that narrow, warped, anti-human sense of the term. So when I became a historian, that when I entered what I soon discovered was a profession, when I became a historian, I already knew that I was not going to be neutral. I already understood for myself that in teaching history or writing history, my point of view was going to be there. I was not going to be what I call a disinterested historian. I had interest. I was not going to be an objective historian, because I didn't really believe objectivity was possible, nor was it desirable. Unless objectivity meant telling the truth as you saw it, not lying, not distorting, not omitting information, and not omitting arguments because they don't conform to some idea that you have. But if objectivity meant not taking a stand, if objectivity meant presenting data without caring about the social effect of the kind of data you present, and that I didn't want that kind of objectivity. History was interesting to me, but I wasn't going into history because it was interesting. Or to put it another way, what was interesting about history is that it represented interests, different kinds of interests. I was very much aware of that. And I was aware as soon as I began to study history that you couldn't really be objective. You couldn't really just recapture the past as it was, a phrase that was used starting in the 19th century when history became a profession in an important sense, reproduce the past as it was, and an idea which is still heard today. I remember reading not long ago an article in the Times Literary Supplement. I like people to think that I'm a regular reader of the Times Literary Supplement. Actually, I just stumbled on this issue of the Times Literary Supplement, and there was an article by Gertrude Himmelfarb. I also like to drop her name once in a while. But Gertrude Himmelfarb is, some of you may know, but she's a historian, a very well-established historian, and I think it's fair to say a conservative historian. And she argued in that article for trying to reproduce the past and get as close to it as possible, argued against what she called postmodernism in history, and for her, postmodernism meant not accepting truth, thinking that there's no such thing as established truth. And she gave as an example of how important it was just to find out as much as you can about any era, how one of her students came to her very excited about a historical discovery, and that was that Andrew Jackson's first message to Congress was written by George Bancroft. You don't seem excited by that idea. But my point is that something like that, you see, that Andrew Jackson's first message to Congress written by George Bancroft, because nobody had found it out before. If somebody hasn't found out anything before and you can bring a new fact to life, This is a very important thing very often, like when you're working on a doctoral dissertation. You work in a field that nobody has ever worked at, no matter how unimportant the field is, it is, you see. And history is an infinite number of events, an infinite number of facts. Inevitably, you must select from that number of facts those things which you are going to present, if you're going to write, if you're going to teach. What is going to go into this book, or what is going to go into your lecture, into your classroom? There's no way of avoiding the process of selection. And once you make that selection is based on your point of view, whether you acknowledge it or not, whether you even know it or not. There's a way in which you can reproduce the point of view that has been dominant in your culture without understanding that you are reproducing the dominant point of view. And so you make a selection according to that point of view. You make a selection according to what you think is important. And different people think different things are important. And she thought that finding out about Andrew Jackson's first message to Congress, and who wrote it, was important. And I say this because there's this huge emphasis, and you know how much discussion there is now about history and arguments about history, argument about history standards, national standards for history. That whole debate has gone on about the standards drawn up in California, which led to a Senate resolution. You know, the Senate is very interested in history and culture and art and things like that. And so the Senate passed a resolution overwhelmingly, you know, denouncing these history standards and calling for a history in which the United States would not be denigrated and so on. So there's all this controversy about history. And much of the controversy sort of ends up with talking about how it is important to know facts. And, well, that's what tests are based on. Standardized tests are based on facts. I remember a few years ago, the New York Times did a survey of high school students to see how much history they knew. And they do this, you know, every few years. They do a survey of young people to prove how dumb they are and to prove how smart are the givers of the tests. And so they gave this test to high school seniors and corroborated what they thought, that young people don't know anything about history. They asked questions like, who was the president during the War of 1812? Who was the president during the Mexican War? Please, I can see you thinking already. We're in a great quiz culture, and all you have to do is drop something. I'm sorry, that was a mistake. But a question like, what came first, the Homestead Act or the Civil Service Act? Well, you recognize questions like that because they're the questions that appear on tests which enable you to get into graduate school. Or you can go very far if you know enough of those answers. You will be Phi Beta Kappa. You will become an advisor to the President of the United States. Do you remember the book, The Best and the Brightest, which was precisely about that point, that the people surrounding the presidents who made the war in Vietnam were the brightest people. They were the people who got the highest scores. They were Phi Beta Kappa. And they were the architects of the war in Vietnam. The New York Times decided it was important. I mean, they could have selected all sorts of questions, but they decided it was important who was president during the Mexican War. By the way, it was James Polk. I want to get that out of the way. Just so did you. You can forget about it now. But I don't want for the rest of my talk for you to be thinking about that. Nothing a speaker hates so much as a distracted audience. So The Times could have asked an important question about the Mexican War. They could have asked, how did the Mexican War start? Ah. Then they might discover, anybody looking into how the Mexican War started, Mexican War, 1846 to 1848, America goes to war against Mexico, ends up with 40% of Mexico's land, a little war, cleanly fought, starts with an incident. One of those incidents which start wars, incidents which have a certain amount of deceit attached to them, in which the an attack is fabricated, or exaggerated, or distorted, and suddenly there's a cause for war. And so there was this disputed territory between Texas and Mexico, the area between the Rio Grande River and the Nueces River, and Mexico claimed it for theirs, the United States claimed it for theirs, a clash between the two troops, and immediately that's it, that's the end, that's enough. President Polk goes to the announces to the nation, American blood has been shed on American soil. Well, a little bit of an exaggeration. I wasn't sure whether it was Mexican soil or American soil, but American blood has been shed upon American soil. The nation is at war. Of course, the decision to find a way to make war with Mexico had been made before that incident. Just as the decision to go to war in Southeast Asia was made before the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But somebody looking into that might then have proceeded to examine our other wars and to examine how these wars start. They might have looked into the war again in the Philippines at the turn of the century and taken a look at a fabricated incident at the beginning of the war in the Philippines, which then enables the United States to make war in the Philippines against the Filipinos, who seem to want to run their own country. But they really aren't a civilized people. And so, you know, I remember President McKinley said, we must Christianize them and civilize them. Filipinos, he said he got that message from God. Filipinos apparently did not get the same message. And they fought back, and there ensued a very bitter, bloody war, which, as I remember when I went to school, occupied a very small part of the history book, whereas the Spanish-American War, a short war, in which we got the Spanish out of Cuba. That was the big thing, the Spanish-American War, Cuba, Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Riders. But the Philippines War, which was a long, bloody war, which was in many ways like the Vietnam War, a war full of massacres, which finally we subdued the Filipinos and took it over. But a look into how wars start might have led to some interesting conclusions about that war. Then might have led to the Gulf of Tonkin. That might have led people to ask more recently, how did we, under Reagan, decide to invade Grenada? What was the incident there? Oh, it was the medical students in trouble. And wherever medical students are in trouble, the U.S. Army goes, you see.
You're listening to Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, part one of a special two-part program from the AR Archive. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of both parts and his great book with the same title, A People's History of the United States, by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-4-